Part 2. Chapter 6. The Age of Show Business. A dedicated graduate student I know returned to his small apartment the night before a major examination, only to discover that his solitary lamp was broken beyond repair. After a whiff of panic, he was able to restore both his equanimity and his chances for a satisfactory grade by turning on the television set, turning off the sound, and, with his back to the set, using its light to read important passages on which he was to be tested. This is one use of television, as a source of illuminating the printed page. But the television screen is more than a light source. It is also a smooth, nearly flat surface on which the printed word may be displayed. We have all stayed at hotels in which the TV set has had a special channel for describing the day's events in letters rolled endlessly across the screen. This is another use of television, as an electronic bulletin board. Many television sets are also large and sturdy enough to bear the weight of a small library. The top of an old-fashioned RCA console can handle as many as 30 books, and I know one woman who has securely placed her entire collection of Dickens, Flaubert, and Turgenev on the top of a 21-inch Westinghouse. Here is still another use of television, as a bookcase. I bring forward these quixotic uses of television to ridicule the hope harbored by some that television can be used to support the literate tradition. Such a hope represents exactly what Marshall McLuhan used to call rear-view mirror thinking, the assumption that a new medium is merely an extension or amplification of an older one, that an automobile, for example, is only a fast horse, or an electric light a powerful candle. To make such a mistake in the matter at hand is to misconstrue entirely how television redefines the meaning of public discourse. Television does not extend or amplify literate culture, it attacks it. If television is a continuation of anything, it is of a tradition begun by the telegraph and photograph in the mid-19th century, not by the printing press in the 15th. What is television? What kinds of conversations does it permit? What are the intellectual tendencies it encourages? What sort of culture does it produce? These are the questions to be addressed in the rest of this book, and to approach them with a minimum of confusion, I must begin by making a distinction between a technology and a medium. We might say that a technology is to a medium as the brain is to the mind. Like the brain, a technology is a physical apparatus. Like the mind, a medium is a use to which a physical apparatus is put. A technology becomes a medium as it employs a particular symbolic code, as it finds its place in a particular social setting, as it insinuates itself into economic and political contexts. A technology, in other words, is merely a machine. A medium is the social and intellectual environment a machine creates. Of course, like the brain itself, every technology has an inherent bias. It has, within its physical form, a predisposition toward being used in certain ways and not others. Only those who know nothing of the history of technology believe that a technology is entirely neutral. There is an old joke that mocks that naive belief. Thomas Edison, it goes, would have revealed his discovery of the electric light much sooner than he did, except for the fact that every time he turned it on, he held it to his mouth and said, "Hello? Hello?" Not very likely. Each technology has an agenda of its own. It is, as I have suggested, a metaphor waiting to unfold. The printing press, for example, had a clear bias toward being used as a linguistic medium. It is conceivable to use it exclusively for the reproduction of pictures, and one imagines the Roman Catholic Church would not have objected to its being so used in the 16th century. Had that been the case, the Protestant Reformation might not have occurred, for, as Luther contended with the Word of God on every family's kitchen table, Christians do not require the papacy to interpret it for them. But in fact, there never was much chance that the press would be used solely, or even very much, for the duplication of icons. From its beginning in the 15th century, the press was perceived as an extraordinary opportunity for the display and mass distribution of written language. Everything about its technical possibilities led in that direction. One might even say it was invented for that purpose. The technology of television has a bias as well. It is conceivable to use television as a lamp, a surface for texts, a bookcase, even as radio. But it has not been so used and will not be so used, at least in America. Thus, in answering the question, what is television, we must understand as a first point that we are not talking about television as a technology, but television as a medium. There are many places in the world where television, though the same technology as it is in America, is an entirely different medium from that which we know. I refer to places where the majority of people do not have television sets, and those who do have only one, where only one station is available, where television does not operate around the clock, where most programs have as their purpose the direct furtherance of government ideology and policy, where commercials are unknown and talking heads are the principal image, where television is mostly used as if it were radio. For these reasons and more, television will not have the same meaning or power as it does in America, which is to say, it is possible for a technology to be so used that its potentialities are prevented from developing and its social consequences kept to a minimum. But in America, this has not been the case. Television has found in liberal democracy and a relatively free market economy a nurturing climate in which its full potentialities as a technology of images could be exploited. One result of this has been that American television programs are in demand all over the world. The total estimate of U.S. television program exports is approximately 100,000 to 200,000 hours, equally divided among Latin America, Asia, and Europe. Over the years, programs like Gunsmoke, Bonanza, Mission Impossible, Star Trek, Kojak, and more recently, Dallas and Dynasty, have been as popular in England, Japan, Israel, and Norway as in Omaha, Nebraska. I have heard, but not verified, that some years ago the Lapps postponed for several days their annual and, one supposes, essential migratory journey so that they could find out who shot J.R. All of this has occurred simultaneously with the decline of America's moral and political prestige worldwide. American television programs are in demand not because America is loved, but because American television is loved. We need not be detained too long in figuring out why. In watching American television, one is reminded of George Bernard Shaw's remark on his first seeing the glittering neon signs of Broadway and 42nd Street at night. "It must be beautiful," he said, "if you cannot read." American television is indeed a beautiful spectacle, a visual delight, pouring forth thousands of images on any given day. The average length of a shot on network television is only 3.5 seconds, so that the eye never rests, always has something new to see. Moreover, television offers viewers a variety of subject matter, requires minimal skills to comprehend it, and is largely aimed at emotional gratification. Even commercials, which some regard as an annoyance, are exquisitely crafted, always pleasing to the eye and accompanied by exciting music. There is no question but that the best photography in the world is presently seen on television commercials. American television, in other words, is devoted entirely to supplying its audience with entertainment. Of course, to say that television is entertaining is merely banal. Such a fact is hardly threatening to a culture, not even worth writing a book about. It may even be a reason for rejoicing. Life, as we like to say, is not a highway strewn with flowers. The sight of a few blossoms here and there may make our journey a trifle more endurable. The Lapps undoubtedly thought so. We may surmise that the 90 million Americans who watch television every night also think so. But what I am claiming here is not that television is entertaining, but that it has made entertainment itself the natural format for the representation of all experience. Our television set keeps us in constant communion with the world, but it does so with a face whose smiling countenance is unalterable. The problem is not that television presents us with entertaining subject matter, but that all subject matter is presented as entertaining, which is another issue altogether. To say it still another way, entertainment is the supra-ideology of all discourse on television. No matter what is depicted or from what point of view, the overarching presumption is that it is there for our amusement and pleasure. That is why, even on news shows, which provide us daily with fragments of tragedy and barbarism, we are urged by the newscasters to join them tomorrow. What for? One would think that several minutes of murder and mayhem would suffice as material for a month of sleepless nights. We accept the newscaster's invitation because we know that the news is not to be taken seriously, that it is all in fun, so to say. Everything about a news show tells us this. The good looks and amiability of the cast, their pleasant banter, the exciting music that opens and closes the show, the vivid film footage, the attractive commercials, all these and more suggest that what we have just seen is no cause for weeping. A news show, to put it plainly, is a format for entertainment, not for education, reflection, or catharsis, and we must not judge too harshly those who have framed it in this way. They are not assembling the news to be read or broadcasting it to be heard. They are televising the news to be seen. They must follow where their medium leads. There is no conspiracy here, no lack of intelligence, only a straightforward recognition that good television has little to do with what is good about exposition or other forms of verbal communication, but everything to do with what the pictorial images look like. I should like to illustrate this point by offering the case of the 80-minute discussion provided by the ABC Network on November 20, 1983, following its controversial movie, The Day After. Though the memory of this telecast has receded for most, I choose this case because, clearly, here was television taking its most serious and responsible stance. Everything that made up this broadcast recommended it as a critical test of television's capacity to depart from an entertainment mode and rise to the level of public instruction. In the first place, the subject was the possibility of a nuclear holocaust. Second, the film itself had been attacked by several influential bodies politic, including the Reverend Jerry Falwell's Moral Majority. Thus, it was important that the network display television's value and serious intentions as a medium of information and coherent discourse. Third, on the program itself, no musical theme was used as background, a significant point since almost all television programs are embedded in music, which helps to tell the audience what emotions are to be called forth. This is a standard theatrical device, and its absence on television is always ominous. Fourth, there were no commercials during the discussion, thus elevating the tone of the event to the state of reverence usually reserved for the funerals of assassinated presidents. And finally, the participants included Henry Kissinger, Robert McNamara, and Elie Wiesel, each of whom is a symbol of sorts of serious discourse. Although Kissinger somewhat later made an appearance on the hit show Dynasty, he was then and still is a paradigm of intellectual sobriety, and Wiesel practically a walking metaphor of social conscience. Indeed, the other members of the cast, Carl Sagan, William Buckley, and General Brent Scowcroft, are, each in his way, men of intellectual bearing who are not expected to participate in trivial public matters. The program began with Ted Koppel, master of ceremonies, so to speak, indicating that what followed was not intended to be a debate, but a discussion. And so those who were interested in philosophies of discourse had an excellent opportunity to observe what serious television means by the word discussion. Here is what it means. Each of six men was given approximately 5 minutes to say something about the subject. There was, however, no agreement on exactly what the subject was, and no one felt obliged to respond to anything anyone else said. In fact, it would have been difficult to do so, since the participants were called upon seriatim, as if they were finalists in a beauty contest, each being given his share of minutes in front of the camera. Thus, if Mr. Wiesel, who was called upon last, had a response to Mr. Buckley, who was called upon first, there would have been four commentaries in between, occupying about 20 minutes, so that the audience, if not Mr. Wiesel himself, would have had difficulty remembering the argument which prompted his response. In fact, the participants, most of whom were no strangers to television, largely avoided addressing each other's points. They used their initial minutes, and then their subsequent ones, to intimate their position or give an impression. Dr. Kissinger, for example, seemed intent on making viewers feel sorry that he was no longer their Secretary of State by reminding everyone of books he had once written, proposals he had once made, and negotiations he had once conducted. Mr. McNamara informed the audience that he had eaten lunch in Germany that very afternoon and went on to say that he had at least 15 proposals to reduce nuclear arms. One would have thought that the discussion would turn on this issue, but the others seemed about as interested in it as they were in what he had for lunch in Germany. Later, he took the initiative to mention three of his proposals, but they were not discussed. Elie Wiesel, in a series of quasi-parables and paradoxes, stressed the tragic nature of the human condition, but because he did not have the time to provide a context for his remarks, he seemed quixotic and confused, conveying an impression of an itinerant rabbi who has wandered into a coven of Gentiles. In other words, this was no discussion, as we normally use the word. Even when the discussion period began, there were no arguments or counterarguments, no scrutiny of assumptions, no explanations, no elaborations, no definitions. Carl Sagan made, in my opinion, the most coherent statement, a 4-minute rationale for a nuclear freeze, but it contained at least 2 questionable assumptions and was not carefully examined. Apparently, no one wanted to take time from his own few minutes to call attention to someone else's. Mr. Koppel, for his part, felt obliged to keep the show moving, and though he occasionally pursued what he discerned as a line of thought, he was more concerned to give each man his fair allotment of time. But it is not time constraints alone that produce such fragmented and discontinuous language. When a television show is in process, it is very nearly impermissible to say, "Let me think about that," or "I don't know," or "What do you mean when you say," or "From what sources does your information come?" This type of discourse not only slows down the tempo of the show, but creates the impression of uncertainty or lack of finish. It tends to reveal people in the act of thinking, which is as disconcerting and boring on television as it is on a Las Vegas stage. Thinking does not play well on television, a fact that television directors discovered long ago. There is not much to see in it. It is, in a phrase, not a performing art. But television demands a performing art, and so what the ABC network gave us was a picture of men of sophisticated verbal skills and political understanding being brought to heel by a medium that requires them to fashion performances rather than ideas, which accounts for why the 80 minutes were very entertaining in the way of a Samuel Beckett play. The intimations of gravity hung heavy, the meaning passeth all understanding. The performances, of course, were highly professional. Sagan abjured the turtleneck sweater in which he starred when he did Cosmos. He even had his hair cut for the event. His part was that of the logical scientist speaking in behalf of the planet. It is to be doubted that Paul Newman could have done better in the role, although Leonard Nimoy might have. Scowcroft was suitably military in his bearing, terse and distant, the unbreakable defender of national security. Kissinger, as always, was superb in the part of the knowing world statesman, weary of the sheer responsibility of keeping disaster at bay. Koppel played to perfection the part of a moderator, pretending, as it were, that he was sorting out ideas, while in fact he was merely directing the performances. At the end, one could only applaud those performances, which is what a good television program always aims to achieve, that is to say, applause, not reflection. I do not say categorically that it is impossible to use television as a carrier of coherent language or thought in process. William Buckley's own program, Firing Line, occasionally shows people in the act of thinking, but who also happen to have television cameras pointed at them. There are other programs, such as Meet the Press or The Open Mind, which clearly strive to maintain a sense of intellectual decorum and typographic tradition, but they are scheduled so that they do not compete with programs of great visual interest, since otherwise they will not be watched. After all, it is not unheard of that a format will occasionally go against the bias of its medium. For example, the most popular radio program of the early 1940s featured a ventriloquist, and in those days I heard more than once the feat of a tap dancer on the Major Bowes Amateur Hour. Indeed, if I am not mistaken, he even once featured a pantomimist. But ventriloquism, dancing, and mime do not play well on radio, just as sustained, complex talk does not play well on television. It can be made to play tolerably well if only one camera is used and the visual image is kept constant, as when the president gives a speech, but this is not television at its best, and it is not television that most people will choose to watch. The single most important fact about television is that people watch it, which is why it is called television. And what they watch and like to watch are moving pictures, millions of them of short duration and dynamic variety. It is in the nature of the medium that it must suppress the content of ideas in order to accommodate the requirements of visual interest, that is to say, to accommodate the values of show business. Films, records, and radio, now that it is an adjunct of the music industry, are, of course, equally devoted to entertaining the culture, and their effects in altering the style of American discourse are not insignificant. But television is different because it encompasses all forms of discourse. No one goes to a movie to find out about government policy or the latest scientific advances. No one buys a record to find out the baseball scores or the weather or the latest murder. No one turns on radio anymore for soap operas or a presidential address if a television set is at hand. But everyone goes to television for all these things and more, which is why television resonates so powerfully throughout the culture. Television is our culture's principal mode of knowing about itself. Therefore, and this is the critical point, how television stages the world becomes the model for how the world is properly to be staged. It is not merely that on the television screen entertainment is the metaphor for all discourse. It is that off the screen the same metaphor prevails. As typography once dictated the style of conducting politics, religion, business, education, law, and other important social matters, television now takes command. In courtrooms, classrooms, operating rooms, boardrooms, churches, and even airplanes, Americans no longer talk to each other, they entertain each other. They do not exchange ideas, they exchange images. They do not argue with propositions, they argue with good looks, celebrities, and commercials. For the message of television as metaphor is not only that all the world is a stage, but that the stage is located in Las Vegas, Nevada. In Chicago, for example, the Reverend Greg Sakowitz, a Roman Catholic priest, mixes his religious teaching with rock and roll music. According to the Associated Press, the Reverend Sakowitz is both an associate pastor at the Church of the Holy Spirit in Schaumburg, a suburb of Chicago, and a disc jockey at WKQX. On his show, The Journey Inward, Father Sakowitz chats in soft tones about such topics as family relationships or commitment and interposes his sermons with the sound of Billboard's Top 10. He says that his preaching is not done in a churchy way and adds, "You don't have to be boring in order to be holy." Meanwhile, in New York City, at St. Patrick's Cathedral, Father John J. O'Connor put on a New York Yankee baseball cap as he mugged his way through his installation as Archbishop of the New York Archdiocese. He got off some excellent gags, at least one of which was specifically directed at Mayor Edward Koch, who was a member of his audience. That is to say, he was a congregant. At his next public performance, the new Archbishop donned a New York Mets baseball cap. These events were, of course, televised, and were vastly entertaining, largely because Archbishop, now Cardinal, O'Connor, has gone Father Sackowitz one better, whereas the latter believes that you don't have to be boring to be holy, the former apparently believes you don't have to be holy at all. In Phoenix, Arizona, Dr. Edward Dietrich performed triple bypass surgery on Bernard Schuller. The operation was successful, which was nice for Mr. Schuller. It was also on television, which was nice for America. The operation was carried by at least 50 television stations in the United States, and also by the British Broadcasting Corporation. A two-man panel of narrators, a play-by-play and color man, so to speak, kept viewers informed about what they were seeing. It was not clear as to why this event was televised, but it resulted in transforming both Dr. Dietrich and Mr. Schuller's chest into celebrities. Perhaps because he has seen too many doctor shows on television, Mr. Schuller was uncommonly confident about the outcome of his surgery. "There is no way in hell they are going to lose me on live TV," he said. As reported with great enthusiasm by both WCBS-TV and WNBC-TV in 1984, the Philadelphia Public Schools have embarked on an experiment in which children will have their curriculum sung to them. Wearing Walkman equipment, students were shown listening to rock music whose lyrics were about the eight parts of speech. Mr. Jocko Henderson, who thought of this idea, is planning to delight students further by subjecting mathematics and history, as well as English, to the rigors of a rock music format. In fact, this is not Mr. Henderson's idea at all. It was pioneered by the Children's Television Workshop, whose television show, Sesame Street, is an expensive illustration of the idea that education is indistinguishable from entertainment. Nonetheless, Mr. Henderson has a point in his favor. Whereas Sesame Street merely attempts to make learning to read a form of light entertainment, the Philadelphia experiment aims to make the classroom itself into a rock concert. In New Bedford, Massachusetts, a rape trial was televised to the delight of audiences who could barely tell the difference between the trial and their favorite midday soap opera. In Florida, trials of varying degrees of seriousness, including murder, are regularly televised and are considered to be more entertaining than most fictional courtroom dramas. All of this is done in the interests of public education. For the same high purpose, plans are afoot, it is rumored, to televise confessionals. To be called Secrets of the Confessional Box, the program will, of course, carry the warning that some of its material may be offensive to children, and therefore parental guidance is suggested. On a United Airlines flight from Chicago to Vancouver, a stewardess announces that its passengers will play a game. The passenger with the most credit cards will win a bottle of champagne. A man from Boston with 12 credit cards wins. A second game requires the passengers to guess the collective age of the cabin crew. A man from Chicago guesses 128 and wins another bottle of wine. During the second game, the air turns choppy and the fasten seatbelt sign goes on. Very few people notice, least of all the cabin crew, who keep up a steady flow of gags on the intercom. When the plane reaches its destination, everyone seems to agree that it's fun to fly from Chicago to Vancouver. On February 7, 1985, the New York Times reported that Professor Charles Pine of Rutgers University, Newark campus, was named Professor of the Year by the Council for the Support and Advancement of Education. In explaining why he has such a great impact on his students, Professor Pine said, "I have some gimmicks I use all the time. If you reach the end of the blackboard, I keep writing on the wall. It always gets a laugh. The way I show what a glass molecule does is to run over to one wall and bounce off it and run over to the other wall." His students are, perhaps, too young to recall that James Cagney used this molecule move to great effect in Yankee Doodle Dandy. If I am not mistaken, Donald O'Connor duplicated it in Singin' in the Rain. So far as I know, it has been used only once before in a classroom. Hegel tried it several times in demonstrating how the dialectical method works. The Pennsylvania Amish try to live in isolation from mainstream American culture. Among other things, their religion opposes the veneration of graven images, which means that the Amish are forbidden to see movies or to be photographed. But apparently their religion has not got around to disallowing seeing movies when they are being photographed. In the summer of 1984, for example, a Paramount Pictures crew descended upon Lancaster County to film the movie Witness, which is about a detective played by Harrison Ford who falls in love with an Amish woman. Although the Amish were warned by their church not to interfere with the filmmakers, it turned out that some Amish welders ran to see the action as soon as their work was done. Other devouts lay in the grass some distance away and looked down on the set with binoculars. "We read about the movie in the paper," said an Amish woman. "The kids even cut out Harrison Ford's picture." She added, "But it doesn't really matter that much to them. Somebody told us he was in Star Wars, but that doesn't mean anything to us." The last time a similar conclusion was drawn was when the executive director of the American Association of Blacksmiths remarked that he had read about the automobile, but that he was convinced it would have no consequences for the future of his organization. In the winter 1984 issue of the official video journal, there appears a full-page advertisement for the Genesis Project. The project aims to convert the Bible into a series of movies. The end product, to be called the New Media Bible, will consist of 225 hours of film and will cost $250 million. Professor John Heyman, whose credits include Saturday Night Fever and Grease, is one of the filmmakers most committed to the project. Simply stated, he is quoted as saying, "I got hooked on the Bible." The famous Israeli actor Topol, best known for his role as Tevi in Fiddler on the Roof, will play the role of Abraham. The advertisement does not say who will star as God, but given the producer's background, there is some concern that it might be John Travolta. At the commencement exercises at Yale University in 1983, several honorary degrees were awarded, including one to Mother Teresa. As she and other humanitarians and scholars each in turn received their awards, the audience applauded appropriately, but with a slight hint of reserve and impatience, for it wished to give its heart to the final recipient, who waited shyly in the wings. As the details of her achievements were being recounted, many people left their seats and surged toward the stage to be closer to the great woman, and when the name Meryl Streep was announced, the audience unleashed a sonic boom of affection to wake the New Haven dead. One man who was present when Bob Hope received his honorary doctorate at another institution said that Dr. Streep's applause surpassed Dr. Hope's. Knowing how to please a crowd as well as anyone, the intellectual leaders at Yale invited Dick Cavett, the talk show host, to deliver the commencement address the following year. It is rumored that this year Don Rickles will receive a doctorate of humane letters, and Lola Falana will give the commencement address. Prior to the 1984 presidential elections, the two candidates confronted each other on television in what were called debates. These events were not in the least like the Lincoln-Douglas debates or anything else that goes by the name. Each candidate was given 5 minutes to address such questions as, "What is or would be your policy in Central America?" His opposite number was then given 1 minute for a rebuttal. In such circumstances, complexity, documentation, and logic can play no role, and indeed on several occasions syntax itself was abandoned entirely. It is no matter. The men were less concerned with giving arguments than with giving off impressions, which is what television does best. Post-debate commentary largely avoided any evaluation of the candidates' ideas, since there were none to evaluate. Instead, the debates were conceived as boxing matches, the relevant question being, who KO'd whom? The answer was determined by the style of the men, how they looked, fixed their gaze, smiled, and delivered one-liners. In the second debate, President Reagan got off a swell one-liner when asked a question about his age. The following day, several newspapers indicated that Ron had KO'd Fritz with his joke. Thus, the leader of the free world is chosen by the people in the age of television. What all of this means is that our culture has moved toward a new way of conducting its business, especially its important business. The nature of its discourse is changing as the demarcation line between what is show business and what is not becomes harder to see with each passing day. Our priests and presidents, our surgeons and lawyers, our educators and newscasters need worry less about satisfying the demands of their discipline than the demands of good showmanship. Had Irving Berlin changed one word in the title of his celebrated song, he would have been as prophetic, albeit more terse, as Aldous Huxley. He need only have written, "There's no business but show business."